Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're interviewing Dr. David Knight. Dr. Knight is an assistant professor of education, finance, and policy at the University of Washington College of Education. His research focuses on the economics of education and school finance. In this month's episode, Dr. Knight walks us through some recent developments in school finance policy that have been implemented to address some of the concerns associated with the pandemic. As always, we hope you find this month's interview interesting and useful.
So we're still working through and recovering from the COVID-19 pandemic, and federal policymakers have made some efforts to increase federal funds to schools in the hope that these monies can support schools to address some of the harms caused by the pandemic. So far, policymakers have allocated almost $200 billion to K-12 public schools. So for listeners who may not be familiar with the process, how does Congress distribute these dollars to schools?
Most of the money in K-12 education comes from state and local governments. Only about 10% of K-12 spending comes from the federal government in a typical year. Of course, the pandemic was a little bit unique. And so what we saw, massive federal stimulus coming in, about, as you mentioned, $200 billion. Typically, the federal government spends about $60 billion a year. And so once that money is allocated, Congress has a few different options for how it's going to be distributed across 12,000 school districts in the country. And this time around, Congress decided to run it through the Title I formula. So the money was distributed to school districts along a pre-existing formula. Title I is a program that serves higher poverty students. So under that formula, the money was on average distributed progressively with respect to family income.
So are there any rules for how these dollars need to be spent?
Well, typically federal funds come with quite a few strings attached, and the stimulus funds are a little unique in that there are very few regulations around how districts are expected to spend the funds. There's a couple requirements that Congress put in. So the first is something called meaningful consultation. We haven't seen much action around this, but the idea was that districts many districts have an unprecedented amount of money that they can make investments with. And the meaningful consultation requirement asked districts to consult with their local communities around spending decisions. The language around that requirement was a little bit vague, and I think that's partly why you haven't seen too much discussion of that particular requirement. Another requirement was that 20% of the money be spent on academic recovery. And so that's the concern was that, if too much of the money is spent on something like capital or something that doesn't address immediate needs, Congress wanted to prevent that. Other than those two restrictions, the last big one is the timeline. So there's each of the three stimulus packages have a sort of a deadline by which funds need to be spent. And the most recent and largest federal stimulus was the American Recovery Plan. What we would call ESSER funds, ESSER 1, 2, and 3 were the three stimulus funds. ESSER 3 dollars have to be spent by the start of the 23-24 school year. So districts have this year and then all of next year to spend the funds. And after that, all of the federal stimulus money is expected to be spent. So that's kind of one of the major regulations that is on the money. It's just around timing.
So do we know anything about how school districts have started to spend these dollars?
Yeah, we don't have really great data systems in place right now, and that's unfortunate for looking at state and district budgeting models. But an initial concern with the stimulus money is that districts weren't spending it, and we did have a lot of staffing challenges, a lot of vacancies, and there was also some supply chain issues that initially made it difficult for districts to spend the funds. Those concerns are largely past, and we're seeing districts spend down their funds at roughly the rate you'd expect to meet the deadline. And so there are some initial reports looking at what districts are spending their funds on. It's a mix of things, first off, but a lot of districts are focused on academic recovery and things around tutoring and extending the day or extending the school year. A lot of different interventions are being tried out.
When you think about, I asked you about how the funds are distributed to school districts, but some of the work that you've done has also looked at within school district inequities, like the allocation of resources between schools. Do you have any concerns about how the dollars might be allocated within districts to address some of the harshest impacts of the pandemic?
Yeah. So, one of the things to take a step back so it's a two-part question, really, because it's about how the money gets to school districts and then what decisions school districts make to get the money to schools and then eventually to spend the money. It's really important to understand how school districts are funded in the first place. And so we've for a long time have used local property taxes to fund schools. And then the problem, obviously, with using local property tax revenues is that there's vast differences in property wealth across school districts. And so we sort of have rich school districts and poor school districts. And that resulted from sort of the U.S.'s history in the way that wealth is accumulated. And so in the 60s and 70s, we finally recognized that's not a good way to fund schools. And so the benefit of local property taxes is that it relies on property taxes, which is not sensitive to shifts in the economy. And so the local property taxes is inequitable, but it's also a stable source of income. So in the 60s and 70s, states realized that reliance solely on local property values was inequitable. And so they started passing laws that infused more state aid. And so what we have now in the 21st century is a system where districts rely on a mix of state and local funding, but higher poverty and lower wealth school districts rely more on state aid, and state aid is more sensitive to shifts in the economy. So when you have a big recession, like we had in the Great Recession, or when we have a major shock to state economies, like with the pandemic, where we see the biggest financial difficulties are in higher poverty or lower wealth school districts, because they're more reliant on state aid. A district that's primarily reliant on local property tax revenues has a more stable source of income. So that's why when you have an economic recession or a major shock to the economy, federal funding is so important to come in and address the deficiencies in state school finance systems. That's an important lesson we learned from the Great Recession. But then the second piece that I need to get to is around the within question. It's on the one hand, you have to put your faith in school districts to make the right decisions because they're on the ground and they're working with principals and teachers and students. And so it's a different context. And like, you look at Seattle Public Schools, they have a very progressive staffing formula. And that's just because like we're Seattle and we like are big blue progressive people, et cetera. And so like you can kind of trust districts. Like if you give districts money, they're going to try to do the right thing. They're right that they know like the people, they know all the principals. And so like, yes, we want to send the money to South Seattle. We know that's the right thing to do. The reason why you have within district funding gaps is because they have staffing formulas that on their surface seem fair or equal. But then when you have experience gaps, then that's going to send all the money to the schools that have more experienced teachers. An experience gap would be where more experienced teachers tend to work at a certain set of schools. And then those schools end up getting more funding just because the teachers there make higher salary because that's how the salary schedule is set up to award experience as it should. So the reason why we have within district funding gaps is often because of labor market factors about where people choose to work, and rather than sort of specific policies that create that are specifically regressive. At the state level, it's different. You've got people making cuts to higher poverty school districts, or you've got, just a lack of willingness to address local disparities in funding. So here in Washington, for example, we have this funding system where we allow, we try to give everybody the same amount. Every district would get the same dollar amount per pupil. And then there's a categorical funding program called the Learning Assistance Program, LAP, that adds another 3% or so, 3 to 6% of funding for districts that serve higher poverty student populations. And then we allow districts to raise their own local funds, and that accounts for another $3,000 to $6,000. And so with LAP, we're talking about $300 to $600, the Learning Assistance Program. And so in a state like Washington, we've basically said, let's pay every district the same amount, give every district the same amount of state funding, and then let them raise whatever they want locally. And so of course you're going to have a regressive system under those sets of assumptions. And so that's where we really do need to change the policy, and we shouldn't be running federal stimulus funds through the state formulas. That's essentially what happened during the Great Recession.
You mentioned that there was a similar package that was implemented by the federal government to provide stimulus funds for schools after the 2008 financial crisis. Obviously, that was a different time, a different situation, and a different set of policy goals. But are there any lessons that we can learn from both the policy that was implemented in 2008 to provide stimulus funds for schools, how that was carried out in the years after the 2008 financial crisis?
Yeah, so we benefited. We learned a lot from that experience. The most important lesson from ARRA, so under President Obama, we passed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act shortly after the Great Recession of 2008-2009. And the idea there was that we were going to run all that federal stimulus money through the state funding formulas. And what we realized was that was not a good policy, primarily because state funding formulas are old, outdated, in many states regressive. So they disadvantaged higher need school districts. And so when we send federal stimulus money through state funding formulas, that money is only going to be distributed as effectively as the state funding formulas distribute money. So we can do better than that. So the other big takeaway from the Great Recession stimulus was around timing. So the federal government set up a fiscal cliff, and where you saw the biggest cuts in state aid following the Great Recession was not immediately after the Great Recession. It was not in 2009 or 2010. It was 11, 12, and 13. And actually the 2014-15 school year, a full 6 years after the Great Recession initially started, was the worst year for school funding and school funding gaps. Things have improved a little bit since then. But essentially what happened was federal stimulus money came in, and states relied on that money. And then when the federal stimulus went up, states cut funding. So if you look at Texas, it wasn't until 2011, for example, Texas cut $4 billion that year. And then over the next several years, you started to see teacher layoffs taking place, all kinds of different cuts. And those cuts in the Great Recession disproportionately impacted higher poverty school districts. And again, that's because those same districts disproportionately rely on state aid as opposed to local tax revenues. The two big lessons from the Great Recession stimulus. Number one, come up with a better formula. So this time around, we use Title I, which is not a perfect formula, but it essentially is based on the number of students in poverty. So we know the Title I formula is going to be at least progressive. And then, so if you look at how federal stimulus money under ARP, the American Recovery Act, the COVID aid, was allocated, it was way more progressive than ARRA. So that's the first big lesson. The second big lesson, I'm not sure we're quite there yet. It's around the timing again. So this money, the COVID stimulus money, has an end date. And so I think there's a lot of district folks that are concerned about how do we sustain the programs when the federal stimulus money dries up. And it's an even bigger concern this time around because we actually got the funding allocation right. We distributed the money progressively, but that means that those districts disproportionately face a fiscal cliff. The districts that got most of the stimulus aid, which are higher poverty districts, are going to be in the most precarious situations at the start of the 23-24 school year when the money starts to dry up. So that's, they definitely have improved the policy design from the Great Recession. But there's, I think, still some concerns out there. There was a couple of other things that the Congress did this time around that I think was interesting. That there's another pot of money that went straight to governor's offices called GEAR, the GEAR funds. I don't have it in front of me, the Governor's Educational Emergency Fund. And like AARP, that money was relatively flexible and governors could use it for K-12 or for higher ed. It needed to be allocated to address educational recovery post during the pandemic. And we studied how those funds were allocated, and we have a paper out last summer in the Journal of Education Finance with a University of Washington master's student, Claire McMorris, and I looked at how different states allocated their GEAR funds. And one of the findings, we compared a couple different states, but two that kind of popped out was California and New York. In California, the governor allocated funds according to district percentage of students with an IEP, who are enrolled in special education. And the idea was that the governor at the time wanted to address special education and thought that those students in particular had needs that went unmet during the pandemic. When we looked at New York, that money, the GEAR fund, was allocated also to K-12, but it was distributed along student poverty. And the interesting piece there was that California's existing state and local funding system is a little more sensitive to student poverty rates and has a more explicit formula that's tied to student poverty, struggles a little bit with the way they fund special education. And so it was an opportunity to add that extra funding pot, the GEAR funding pot, allows governors to have a little flexibility around how they're going to spend money. And we showed in our study that what governors decided to do was in some sense related to their local context.
Let me go back to 2008 and ask you about the fallout from the fiscal cliff. And I want to ask you sort of a two-part question. One is we know what happened in 2011, 12, and 13. There was this fiscal cliff and states didn't re-up the state funding that had gone away during the 2008 fiscal or financial crisis, and then federal funds ran out. So the first question is, what happened? What were districts forced to do? And then the second part of the question is, how can we avoid that today? Because we're facing a pending fiscal cliff, and we're also combating the losses and opportunities that students experienced during the pandemic. I imagine the last thing we want to do is, we didn't want to do it in 2011, face these budget cuts, but I imagine the last thing we want to do now is set kids back even further. So what happened in 2008? And then how do we avoid that today? Just a small question for you.
Yeah, that's right. So when you get to the point of a district facing serious financial challenges, that's a real big problem. We want to prevent that from ever happening. If state governments are in trouble, you know, the federal government can bail them out, but it's really problematic when a school district needs to make cuts. And so what we saw following the Great Recession was school districts across the country were engaging in teacher layoffs. And at the time, we were working with the Los Angeles Unified School District, who unfortunately had four straight years of teacher layoffs. And so we were looking at how those layoffs were distributed. In 2008-09, we found that students who identified as Latinx or Black were over twice as likely to have their teacher laid off compared to white students. And low-income students were also more likely to have their teacher laid off compared to non-low-income students. The reason why that is, most districts around the country, when they are forced to make staff layoffs, they use a last-in-first-out policy where those who have been around longer are generally protected from budget-based layoffs. Teachers who have just started are generally targeted first within each subject area. I mean, the first step is to decide which subject areas are highest need, and they will typically protect special education teachers and math and science teachers and English language learner professionals and those sorts. But when they start cutting junior teachers, the problem is most school districts also have something called a teacher experience gap, where the most veteran teachers work in more advantaged schools. And so an across the board layoff strategy that targets novice teachers is going to disproportionately impact students of color and low income students. And that's because novice teachers are clustered in schools that serve more of those students. And so after that first year of layoffs in Los Angeles, a local chapter of the ACLU brought a lawsuit alleging that the layoffs were disproportionately impacting low-income students and students of color. And there was another round of layoffs the following year, but then the case, the plaintiffs were successful, and the judge ruled that you cannot have a district-wide layoff that's so inequitable. And so the district in this case was forced to protect 45 schools from budget-based layoffs. But that's one court case that took place in one school district. And across the country, teachers were receiving pink slips and getting laid off. And we know that in most cases, those layoffs were done by seniority. And so they very likely were distributed inequitably. And they almost definitely disproportionately hurt low-income kids and students of color. We have to make sure we do not put school districts in a position where they're going to need to make cuts. I think that there's a lot of concern that is what we might be looking at here in the next few years when federal stimulus funds run out.
So in addition to that, there's a high likelihood that we'll face an economic recession. We've already seen trends in declining enrollment in large urban school districts across the country. And then we've continued to see this persistence of inflation. So as policymakers think about what the next steps might be, both federal and state policymakers, do you have any recommendations for them for how they might think about maybe reforms? You mentioned state finance formulas, or perhaps some additional federal stimulus funding that might be needed. Are there things that you think policymakers can do to try to limit the impact of some of these, not only the pandemic, but some of these economic trends that we've seen emerge?
Yeah, I mean, we talk so much about test scores and test score gaps and then funding rates and these different things, but we don't talk as much about cost and what it costs to produce the outcomes that we want or expect to see. And that can go both ways. The cost of a particular issue. So we think about teacher turnover and how costly that is for school districts. Well, some schools and districts don't have a big turnover problem, and other districts lose half their staff every few years. That's a huge cost. And so when we think about how much does each district need to be successful, well, if you've got vast differences in turnover, then you've got vast differences in cost. And so you have to have vast differences in funding that needs to address those differences. The other question is, well, if we just look across geographies and across school districts and different contexts, the idea that it would cost the same amount to produce equal educational opportunity in Bellevue, Washington, as it would in South Seattle, doesn't make sense. We cannot have a flat funding system that assumes it costs the same to produce high quality education in every context. It just doesn't. And we know that from decades of research. And moreover, we know that it costs a lot more to produce high outcomes in communities that government policies have traditionally disadvantaged. And that's sort of the crux of it, I think.
Okay, so let me ask you about maybe a specific thing that a state could do. Are you aware of any sort of reforms that states can undertake to remedy some of the inequities or inadequacies that we've seen school districts experience in the past?
Yeah, we're seeing quite a bit of reforms around the country right now around state school finance systems. And in many cases, it's court mandated because school districts and families, communities will kind of bind together and sue the state because the state's school finance system is not constitutional. It's not meeting the constitutional obligations in the state constitution. This has happened in you know, almost every state has had a state school finance court case that has gone one way or the other. When they go in favor of plaintiffs, then the state legislature is tasked with making reforms that address with the court mandates. And so around the country, many states are adopting big state school finance reforms and have over the past 30 to 40 years. And sometimes they're more successful than others. That the research shows that on average, when a state reforms its finance system and infuses a lot of money, and when they target that money to school districts with more need, then you see huge improvements in students' long-term life outcomes. And that's one of the biggest findings that come out of the past few years is just how important school finance reforms are, how fundamental the role of money is in schools, and how difficult it is to make change when you're working within an underfunded system. But it doesn't always work as intended. So one example is here in Washington. We had a state school finance case called the McCleary v. Washington case. And that was about, like a lot of states, plaintiffs argued that the system was not was underfunded. And the courts agreed and called on the state legislature to dramatically increase funding. So the case was about adequacy, whether or not the size of the pie is large enough. What we have found in some of our recent studies is that all districts benefited from the funding increases, but that wealthier, lower poverty school districts saw the largest increases. And so what we're trying to do now is figure out exactly why that happened and what the state could do differently, and also how other states could reform their system in a way that didn't create those same disparities. And so it's not an easy set of policies to enact because you've got a whole state worth of stakeholders to please. And so, you know, it's challenging. But in Washington, we tried to both provide a cost of living adjustment, which we called regionalization factors, and put in tax and expenditure limits, which we call levy lids. And together, those two policies ended up creating a largely a regressive system. And that's what we have now. And so we're trying to figure out that there are policies you can use to ameliorate that, our current system. But Washington's not unique in this realm. Many states have regressive school finance systems. And so, you know, it's important first and foremost to analyze the system that you have and then look for areas where you can make it better.
Dr. Knight, thank you again for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember, for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweets.